You're listening to a podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Hard Talk with me, Zainab Badawi. Thanks for downloading this edition of the programme, and I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Zainab Badawi, at the US Embassy in London. My guest today is Victoria Nuland, US Assistant Secretary of State. Does Washington have any power to influence events in Ukraine? The country has been in the throes of a violent standoff between pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine and the interim government in Kiev since the former president Viktor Yanukovych was ousted in February. Dozens have been killed and Crimea has been taken over by Moscow. What is Washington's strategy to stop Ukraine from further disintegration? Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland, welcome to Hard Talk.
Thank you, Zainab. Great to be here with you.
How would you describe what's going on in Ukraine? You've got separatists fighting Ukrainian soldiers, holding government buildings and also holding independence referendums.
Well, Zainab, what's most important that's happening in Ukraine now is that the entire country is preparing for a presidential election on May 25th. And the vast majority of Ukrainian territory is peaceful and people are excited about their opportunity to vote. But as you said, we've got parts of Ukraine in the east near the Russian border where we've got little green men and separatists trying to decide for people rather than letting them vote.
Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, told Bloomberg TV on May the 14th, "When Ukrainians kill Ukrainians, I believe this is as close to a civil war as you can get." Is it close to civil war in Washington's view in Ukraine?
Absolutely not. As I said, there are some very hot towns in Ukraine, mostly in the east. In Slavyansk, in Kramatorsk, where we have seen violence, there are buildings being held in eastern towns. But this does not represent the views of the vast majority of Ukrainians. Even in the east, 75% of them say that they don't want any part of this separatism. And we believe this is inspired from the outside.
That's 30% of the population, the people following those men in green suits, as you say. That's a lot of people. You can't just dismiss them. They have to be incorporated somehow, don't they, into this dialogue?
They absolutely have to be incorporated, which is why we are gratified to see the Ukrainian government and Ukrainian officials from across the space now working with the OSCE, working with us and the EU, to institute a national dialogue about the direction that the country is going in, talking about things like constitutional reform, decentralization of power. You know, Ukraine was always a place where the folks in Kiev held all the money, held all the power. That's not appropriate in a modern state, and I think everybody agrees with that. But it's also not appropriate to achieve political ends at the barrel of a gun.
As you say, Kiev has launched this political dialogue with politicians and civic groups to try to keep the country together, but it does not include a lot of the rebel leaders. One senior Ukrainian MP, Nesta Shufrich, says without their participation, the round tables would just amount to declarations. You need them there, and they're not being included at the moment. The Ukrainian acting government says don't want them there.
Zainab, in the first national roundtable that happened on May 14th, in fact, a broad cross-section of politicians, civil leaders from the east were included. But folks who are holding buildings, folks who have armed themselves, are going to have to put down their weapons if they want to be included. You can't, on the one hand, threaten and terrorize citizens, and on the other hand, say, let's talk about it. You have to accept amnesty first.
But don't you think that somehow you've got to incorporate those people? And the government in Ukraine doesn't seem to be minded at all to do that. The acting president, Oleksandr Turchinov, says, "We will not engage in dialogue with those who have blood on their hands and are prepared to defend their interests through legitimate means of persuasion. That's all right, but we will not fight terrorists, saboteurs and criminals." That doesn't sound like it's conciliatory enough to the people you need to bring into the dialogue.
Again, the vast majority of folks in the East don't want to have this conversation about devolution of power through the barrel of a gun. You're talking about a small number of guys who have heavily armed themselves with outside support who are saying, we know best. What these roundtables offer are a chance for legitimate citizens to work this out and to say to separatists, we can achieve our goals without you, thank you very much. And in fact, they are in cities across Ukraine that have seen violence turning against separatists. You remember that there was this terrible tragedy in Odessa. And since then, you've had the citizens of Odessa say, our police aren't strong enough. We are going to police the streets ourselves because we want to vote and we want to settle our problems with Kyiv politically. We don't want guys from the outside. We don't want weapons on our streets. We don't want Russia telling us what to do. That's what we're supporting, the right of Ukrainians to choose.
You say that there should be devolution in Ukraine for some of the regions. How much should it amount to federalization, for instance, as the Russians are advocating?
Well, the Russians have made that F word a bad word in Ukraine, because what they want, or what they've talked about, is the right of Ukraine's regions to secede. In fact, they're asking for things in Ukraine that they would never allow in Russia. But what Ukrainians are now talking about is actually devolving all of the powers of the state except foreign policy, defense, and justice to the regions. So they would be able to collect their own taxes and keep them. They'd be able to decide on local languages. They'd be able to elect their leaders.
But if that doesn't go far enough for the separatists in eastern Ukraine, you're not going to have a solution to the problem, are you? You're going to carry on having them destabilizing the situation.
Again, what we are already seeing as a result of the roundtable that has started, the dialogue that the Ukrainian government has initiated, the fact that the OSCE and Europe and we are part of it, is we're seeing citizens in these towns saying, wait a minute, who are you guys with the guns? We can solve this another way. So what you're seeing is that this process is separating the hardcore who don't represent the Ukrainian people from the population. And that's a good thing.
Does the United States think that Russia wants to incorporate the Donetsk region in eastern Ukraine into the Russian Federation?
Well, we've been concerned about it, Zainab. As you know, what just happened in the east is very reminiscent of the playbook that we saw in Crimea. You instigate an independence movement. You have a fake vote on 2 weeks' notice. Then you declare, you know, massive participation, and then you come in with your peacekeepers. Look, we have to take President Putin seriously when he says that Russia should think about going back to the days of Catherine the Great and a Novo Russia. We believe that, you know, if you don't take leaders seriously when they say these kinds of things, then you're not prepared.
But if Washington believes that there's a possibility that Russia may try to annex part of eastern Ukraine, what can you do about that? What's the stick that you can wave at Russia?
Well, the stick that we have been waving, the cost, as President Obama puts it, is increasing isolation and increasing economic sanctions for Russia if it continues to violate international law and takes pieces of another country by force, as it did in Crimea. So, as you know, when President Obama was here in March, he made clear that if Russia used the 40,000 troops that it still has deployed right on Ukraine's borders and came over the border, that that would trigger even deeper economic sanctions from the United States and from our European partners. But what we've seen with these little green men causing trouble around the east is that there can be plenty of outside interference short of troops. And so when Chancellor Merkel was in Washington just a little while ago, she and President Obama agreed that if these elections are disrupted from the outside, then there will be even deeper economic sanctions. And so, that was part of what we were in Europe today talking about.
So the sanctions stay as they are unless Russia goes into eastern Ukraine and unless Russia disrupts the presidential elections in Ukraine on May the 25th.
If there is continued destabilization in Ukraine, there'll be more sanctions. If there is destabilization of the elections, there will be deep, strong sectoral sanctions.
So basically, Russia has got away with annexing Crimea, but the sanctions stay where they are, and the fact of the matter is Russia can live with the sanctions as they are.
Well, first of all, with regard to Crimea, we have continued to escalate the sanctions in Crimea. The European Union put more sanctions on Crimean officials, Crimean entities. Just a few days ago, the U.S. has done two rounds of sanctions, and we will continue to add them if Russia doesn't roll back from Crimea. So that's one thing. Second, with regard to living with them, they're talking tough in Moscow, but the numbers tell a different story, Zainab. The numbers show that Russia has already spent, just in the last couple of weeks, some $30 billion propping up the ruble, that their economy is hovering close to the recession line, that their bond issuance is just above junk now. Inflation is
running
rampant.
But they may think that's worth it because they want to keep Crimea, as the former Assistant Secretary of State Nicholas Burns said in a British newspaper recently. Understanding the Russians and knowing what Putin is like, the chances are high Putin will never leave Crimea. Is the United States going to accept that.
We will not accept the illegal occupation of Crimea, and nor will Europe, in the same way that we never accepted the illegal occupation of Abkhazia.
But there's not a lot you can do about it, apart from the fact you just say that the costs of absorption are very high for Russia, but Russia says we'll live with that. There's not a great deal you can do. Sanctions are a blunt instrument because they will hurt not only the European Union, but other countries in the world just as much as they'll hurt Russia.
Well, first of all, with regard to Crimea, the economy there is already a basket case as a result of the sanctions that have been put on. And as I said, there will be more. Crimea will be a no-go zone for U.S. and European business if he does not roll back. But I would also say that we are talking intensively to the Europeans now on what we call scalpel sanctions. We believe that given Russia's dependence on the European market, which is 50% of their market as compared to 9% for Europe, there are plenty of further measures that we can take.
But if you look at what the American ambassador to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, has recently said, he says Russia is increasingly building walls around its economy. So it's doing that by looking more to what it produces itself is what it buys. But also, as has been observed, it's looking at new trading partners or increasing ties with countries like Kazakhstan, Belarus, countries in its own backyard. So it could afford to live without the West in due course.
It actually can't, Zainab. That is the failure strategy for Russia. That's back to the 19th century, not the 21st century. And that's partly why the IMF is saying that Russia is hovering on the verge of recession now. That those trading partners are not a growth strategy for Russia. They are back to being a 20th century gas station, depending upon, you know, your forests and your timber and all those kinds of things. And if Putin goes in that direction, the Russian people will sincerely suffer.
The European Bank for Reconstruction and Development has said, yes, Russia will see growth go to perhaps zero, it'll be stagnant, but it says that the Ukrainian economy is going to contract by 7%. As a result of the crisis and the sanctions that are going on, because Ukraine depends a great deal on Russia for its energy. And it's also the pipeline that goes through Ukraine to other parts of Europe. That's the point. Russia's so integrated into the European economy. Hurt Russia, you hurt everybody else.
Again, on the Ukraine-Russia energy side, as the major transit country for Russian gas to Europe, Russia cannot afford to cut off its gas trade with Ukraine, as we saw in 2010 when that blockade lasted for a couple of days. However, what part of the strategy for Ukraine and part of the reason that Ukrainians went into the street is they want to be less dependent on Russia. They want to diversify and be more integrated with Europe. That's why...
That's going to take time, though, isn't it? I mean, it's
actually
going to take time.
One of the greatest gifts of the European Union, one of its greatest exports, is its ability to associate with countries on its borders. And the association agreement that the EU has offered Ukraine will open up all kinds of new trading opportunities and will give them far more choice than they've had in the past. And that's partly why Ukrainians went into the streets in the first place. You remember that the Maidan movement began when their former president told them that they couldn't have association with the EU, that they had to stay in a stranglehold with Russia.
But
they don't want that.
The sanctions are limited. Lots of people saying this. Fred Kaplan, Council on Foreign Relations, said on April the 28th, if the Western Europeans don't go along with what you would like, then these deeper sanctions are mere theatre. And we see examples. The French, for instance, do not want to abandon selling their assault helicopters to the Russians because they say, look, we need the sale. So you're not going to see European countries really cooperating with the kind of sanctions that you say you need.
In fact, we're having a very good conversation with Europe now on a package of sanctions in a few in each of the sectors where we can share the pain and minimize the impact on us. I think that, you know, all European countries understand that new defense investments in Russia are a bad idea. In fact, what we're talking about at the government level would codify what's already happening in the private sector. As I go around Europe and talk to European businesses, they've already decided that Russia is a bad risk for business. There are very few new loans.
But
there are very few new things happening.
On that 1.2 billion euro sale of two helicopter assault ships to Russia from the French, is that okay for that to go ahead?
Well, we're all having a conversation about an appropriate defense relationship with a Russia that would violate international law and go in and eat a chunk of its neighbor's territory. Defense issues are very much on the table in the conversation that we're having with
our
European partners.
French they shouldn't honor that contract.
We've been pretty clear all the way through, even well before this started, how we feel about that particular sale.
Which is what?
We have never thought it was the best idea. I think there is a question of whether it can be stripped down or whether there are other ways to handle that. But that conversation is ongoing.
But the French aren't listening, are they? I mean, the French are not listening. They say it's going to go ahead, and they say that these sanctions cannot be applied retrospectively and that this contract was signed before any of this happened.
Again, I think that we can have a very profound impact on the Russian economy if we need to, if they don't make a better choice in Ukraine, looking at future contracts, but also we're having a very good and clear conversation among ourselves about what the right posture in defense terms with Russia, with a Russia that would do this.
Does that conversation also involve deals between Rosneft, the state energy company in Russia, and private sector, big oil companies? ExxonMobil, 2011, signed an agreement with Rosneft. Would that be incorporated in the kind of sanctions America would like to see?
Again, I think we have to, given what we've seen and given the potential for even more threats to global security, to European security. We can't take anything off the table at the moment. But as I said, we do believe we can do this with a scalpel. We do believe we can make it impact the Russian economy far more than it impacts ours.
So ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, all these oil companies that have agreements one way or another with Rosneft, Gazprom, they're okay.
I would call your attention to the fact that there is a very big energy symposium, public-private meeting in Russia in the next couple of weeks. And virtually all of those companies have made clear that they don't intend for their CEOs to attend.
Do you see any difference in approach to this question of sanctions between you and the European Union, which has much deeper ties with Russia than you do?
Well, obviously, the way Europe's economy is structured, the way individual nation states within the EU's economies are structured, has to be taken into account. So everybody has to do their own analysis. We're more vulnerable in some areas. Europe's more vulnerable in other areas. So that is the work that is ongoing now as we prepare these sanctions packages. I think they won't be identical as a result of that, but they'll be complementary.
I have to ask you, of course, as you came to attention in February because of that bugged conversation between you and Jeffrey Pyatt, the American ambassador in Ukraine, when you were discussing what the makeup of the new interim government might look like. And you used an unfortunate derogatory remark, used a swear word about the Europeans. Do you regret having used that? And what would you say now?
Well, first of all, Zainab, to underscore, it was a private telephone conversation that was put on the street by the Russian Federation. I don't think there's a human in the U.S. or in the EU who hasn't used an unfortunate expression in a private phone conversation in the past. We were expressing a temporary frustration where the Ukrainians were looking for an international organization to come and support this dialogue, and the EU was not forthcoming, so we ended up asking the UN to come in. But as a broader matter, we have superb relations with the EU, as we have on this issue, and we've been working, as we've been discussing here, in lockstep, both in supporting Ukraine and their right to choose, and in preparing costs for Russia.
President François Hollande of France said in early May in a radio interview that Russia might not have been emboldened to seize Crimea for this reason. He said, when chemical weapons were used in Syria, I said we must intervene even if there is no UN Security Council. The Americans preferred another means. Not having stopped Assad at that moment has been a signal heard by others today. Does he have a point?
I completely reject that. The notion that we chose to negotiate in order to remove chemical weapons rather than use military means, gives another country the right to use military means against its neighbor. The logic escapes me there, Zainab.
But, I mean, it's not just a point that he's made. Carl Bildt, the Swedish foreign minister, when asked by one journalist recently why Putin was emboldened, said Putin has seen the United States absent from the geopolitics of the Eurasian area. So it's not just the French saying this. And I put it to you that why do you think, then, Vladimir Putin has been emboldened?
I've never been interested in trying to get inside the brain of Vladimir Putin. I think that's a bad parlor game. What's important here is that when a leader makes the kinds of choices that he's made to violate international law, to take a bite out of a neighbor's territory by force, to continue to intimidate with 40,000 troops, the international community, the U.S. and Europe, have to say that this is unacceptable, this will have costs. At the same time that we say that if you change course, there can be a diplomatic de-escalation, and we're also trying to do that.
But just looking at the issue raised about America's place in the world from the comments that Carl Bildt, President Hollande have been making, we know that President Obama himself has said that he doesn't want to use the military option at all. And he said, you know, recently, I can't understand why everybody is so eager for us to use military force after we've just been through a decade of war at enormous cost to our troops and our budget. We're seeing the defense budget cut in the US and so on. So really, I put it to you that now US foreign policy begins at home. You're too busy sorting out your own problems at home to be active internationally.
You know, I would reject that as well. And let's go back to the NATO example. The minute we saw what we saw in Crimea, NATO gathered and we agreed that we had to make it absolutely clear to President Putin that NATO space is inviolable, that we will defend every inch of it. And you immediately saw the deployment on land, on the sea, in the air, of NATO assets to protect all of those frontline states, including 750 U.S. troops now in Europe, including a quadrupling of our air assets, U.S. ships in the Black Sea. So I would not say that this has been a challenge that has been devoid of military requirements.
So the U.S. is not a power in retreat?
You know, I would reject that. I think if you look at any of the serious crises that we're dealing with on the planet, the United States is at the center of the international response. The negotiations that we're having with Iran now, the U.S. and Europe do that together. The U.S. is very much at the center of this policy of addressing the Ukraine challenge by supporting Ukraine on the one hand, making it cost for Russia, keeping diplomacy open. You saw my boss, Secretary Kerry, in South Sudan trying to negotiate that conflict. You see American forces going to support the Nigerians in the context of Boko Haram. So I think we continue to play our traditional role of trying to galvanize the world but stay very much at the center of leadership.
Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland, thank you very much indeed for coming on Hard Talk.
Thank you, Zainab.
Thank you. This edition of Hard Talk was presented by me, Zainab Badawi. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.